Hello, welcome to the House of Commons podcast. This is a regular podcast featuring myself, Mark Thompson, Lib Dem blogger, and also regularly featuring my co-host Emma Burnell, who blogs at Scarlet Standard, but this week has been promoted to temporary editor of Labour List. Hello.
I have indeed. It's a promotion indeed. I'm quite a significantly larger readership, sadly, than my poor little Scarlet Standard.
How's it been going?
It's been intense. It's been fascinating. I'm trying to work out how I can knock off Mark Ferguson in a nice, friendly way, because he is a really good person. I could do it permanently.
Well, yeah, okay. Yeah, let me know how that goes. And also, we're delighted to be joined tonight by Kate Maltby, who is a board member of Bright Blue Think Tank and also the editor of the magazine. Good evening, Kate.
Hi, great to be with you.
Good to have you. Okay, so the first thing we thought we'd talk about, which is the biggest political story of the week, is the spending review. So George Osborne obviously announced what was going to happen and cuts to various departments and also ring fences to various other departments. But I think the general consensus from the commentariat seems to be that it was a very political budget. Emma, what did you make of it? And also, what did you make of Ed Balls' response?
Yeah, it was a very, very political budget. It was, I mean, I've read from several different commentators from several different sides of the aisle, as it were, over the last few days, that George Osborne isn't particularly interested in the economics. He's interested in the politics. It was a budget that was designed to trap Labour into certain positions rather than a budget that was designed to improve our economic matters. And it was a budget statement that he didn't want to have to make, because when he made his first big spending review, that was, you know, very much supposed to be it. If what he thought he could pull off, he had in fact pulled off, this would be the point where he would have been trying to introduce some pre-electoral sweeties. And that has been completely and utterly not the case. We are all suffering from the failure of George Osborne's economic plans, and what he's trying to do rather cleverly, but maybe less so if everyone can see the man behind the curtain, is to use his failure in such a way as to trap Labour into the kind of stereotypes he believes that we want to be promoting, so he can fight against this in the way that he would like to do.
Isn't it? What stereotypes are those then?
He wants to try and promote Labour as profligate, to promote Labour as the people who got us into the mess in the first place, and that the mess is deeper than we ever could have considered. And it's not the Tories' fault at all as to why spending and growth fell off a cliff shortly after they took power.
A good week for that note from Liam Byrne to have been miraculously actually leaked. The point about the photo is it's not made up. It really does exist.
Well, yeah, but also the point about jokes is that they're kind of, you know, jokes.
They're always funny because there's a bit of truth in them.
The idea that there is no money left has a grain of truth in it. There is plenty of money. Government's not spending nothing. But it's not the case that there's no money left. Also, it's not there's no money left, it's there's no money. And that's quite an interesting difference, because it's
yes,
a different story. That there's no money left, that we've been hearing for 3 years from lovely David Laws, that would indicate that there was money and it's been spent. There's no money indicates we're in the middle of a really deep recession.
Well, I don't think anyone's going to disagree about the extent of the recession, but
a little bit of spin, that little word left, isn't it?
Is that directed at me, Emma, the Lib Dem on the podcast?
We've been waiting for you to leap into this one.
Well, yeah, I agree. He should have not included the word left when he first mentioned it. But if I understand correctly, he actually hadn't planned to mention it. He just kind of mentioned it in passing in some forum.
And if you believe that, then you're still getting 50p from the Tooth Fairy.
That is my understanding of how it came about. But I've said this before. I actually don't think Laws should have leaked what was said in that letter, because I think there is a pretty well-recognised convention that ministers leave notes for their successors, and they're supposed to be private, and they might be a bit jokey, and they might be quite candid. And really, they shouldn't be leaked. And I think Laws has completely bollocksed up that convention now, because ministers are going to be really wary about what they say in letters. They'll just be bland and, you know, the kind of thing that they'd be happy to put on a press release. So, you know,
But there's a difference between the formal letter that lays out, you know, significant bullet points and the jokey little note that lasts lasts just for one line. Surely people will still recognize the importance of a handover, of a transfer note. This was of a different order.
Of course, but you know, those notes that are left are supposed to be for the successor's eyes only, and then I don't think there's ever been a case of them having been leaked before, except in memoirs 20, 30 years later, and it doesn't matter anymore. Certainly not used as a party political point scoring exercise. I just wanted to come back to what you were saying though, Emma, about about George Osborne and the political side of things, because I find it quite interesting that. Really, I think you're right. I think George Osborne stood up at this spending review. And really, what he was saying, in essence, was our plans from 3 years ago haven't worked out properly and we're having to do this. Now, he had his justifications and his reasons for why, which we could argue about till the cows come home. But what I find most interesting is that the narrative has changed. The narrative a year or so ago was Omni shambles. George Osborne has messed this up. His star is fading. His star is rising again. Why do you think that is?
Because who else is going to do that job? And I think people have started to realise that we're in the downhill run towards the next election now, and they're not going to get rid of Osborne, so they have to get behind him. There's enough space between what Osborne wants to do and what Balls wants to do for the Tories to get in line behind Osborne.
Sorry, Kate, you're going to say something.
Yes, well, all I was going to say is it's not just a question of we haven't got another potential chancellor. And it's not that people, that Osborne's star is rising as a candidate to hold on to that job for the next 2 years. The people I know in the Tory party is suddenly beginning to talk about him as a candidate for the leadership again, it's slightly concerning, but a year ago the loyalist candidate was going to be Gove again. People had Osborne had accepted it, the people around him had accepted it. Gove was considered more electable, which is sort of funny when you talk to most people on the street, even I will agree. But within the Tory party he's popular, passionately popular in a way that Osborne is. But people are now talking about the Osborne versus Boris contest again, which 6 months ago would have been unheard of.
Yeah, I've heard similar stuff to that as well. And it does seem quite strange to me, because it really felt a year or so ago like he was down and out. And yeah, now he's being talked about as a potential leadership challenger. I can't see it myself. I can't imagine him as prime minister. It's the same kind of problem I wasn't really old enough at the time, but when I kind of look back, same problem I would have had with Michael Foote being prime minister. It just doesn't work for me. It doesn't fit.
It's the Gideon tag, isn't it? It's that sense that he's been presented by the press as never quite having succeeded in any of the things he's quite wanted in life. I mean, that may be unfair, but when you read the old Bullingdon stories, he's always the one who was slightly hanging on, isn't he? I mean, I wasn't around in Oxford 20 years ago. That may be completely unfair, but all that, you know, he only went to St Paul's Boys stuff. He's not really an Etonian. They used to call him Oik. That sort of, what's really sad about that is it's picked up by people who themselves would reject those snobbish values, who would who wouldn't want to be the bully boys leading the pack, but still piggyback on the fact that other posh Tories have treated George Osborne like that in the past in order to continue to do so themselves. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a really interesting perspective. I hadn't really thought of it like that. It's kind of alien to me that George Osborne isn't posh enough to lead the Tories, but I completely understand that perspective. That's a really, really quite interesting revelation.
It's different levels of posh,
having
isn't it?
A younger brother who went to St Paul's Boys and was called not posh enough by the local Holland Park Etonians, I can tell you that there are people out there. But it is odd that he's a sort of he seems to have been a candidate for bullying at, you know, several points in his life where he's seen that. I mean, we're only talking about perception here. We're not really talking about reality. But he's seen as always been slightly the runt of the pack.
I mean, I think he's your classic sidekick, isn't he, really, rather than your classic leader. He's, you know, he's the man with the plan in the background, rather than the man who's getting out there and fronting things up. And he doesn't help himself in that measure, because he does very little television. There's very few interviews, and he's not terribly good at them when he does do them. So I think he isn't out there explaining himself and giving himself another narrative.
And yet he's wonderfully witty and cynical, with just the right sort of level of humanity in his cynicism. On a personal level, he's much, dare I say it, cooler than he appears in public.
Ah, but you see, we've heard all of this sort of thing before. I'm getting massive alarm bells ringing here of what people used to say about Gordon Brown before he became Prime Minister.
Oh, yes, I remember
which was
that.
Oh, but Gordon, one-to-one, he's absolutely wonderful. You'll see, once he assumes the mantle of Prime Minister, he will grow into that role very quickly. And actually, we know what happened. It didn't work out like that at all. And I don't know, maybe I'm being unfair, because I suppose I've just been, as you've been talking about that, I've been thinking about why is it that I can't see him as Prime Minister, and it is, it's a personal thing. It's that he's got a squeaky voice, and he doesn't look like a Prime Minister, and that's really terribly unfair, isn't it? Because what should a Prime Minister look like?
I think there are plenty of better reasons to think that George Osborne would not be a good Prime Minister than his inability to speak without his voice going.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely.
Emma, the reasons why you will object to him will be reasons that Cameron would applaud him for. I mean, he's been the backroom boy of the Cameron engine, and Cameron himself, love him or loathe him, was an electable figure, and more partly just because he was more presentable on TV with the same plan.
Yeah, but I don't think it's just me. I mean, you're not going to get my vote, but I think that the public don't see Osborne as somebody who, you know, has the best interest of the whole public at heart. And I think they probably think that more than they think about Cameron. It'd be very interesting to see, because they never do split them in the polling, but it would be interesting to see who gets a higher, you know, is all in it together, is making the cuts in a fair way polling, because my instinct would be that Osborne would score less well on that than Cameron.
Yes, but I would say that that's perception, because actually they're a very good double act. But I agree that is the perception. I mean, I knew people at the last election who were swing voters, fundamentally centrists, who said the reason that they were not voting Tory was George Osborne. Ironically, those people tended to vote Lib Dem, but, you know.
So they got him anyway.
I was wondering if we could maybe just move on to Ed Bulls, because obviously he responded to the spending review statement. That wouldn't have been the case of an actual budget, but, you know, we're in this weird world where we have budgets and then we have spending reviews and then we have pre-budget statements. So there's quite a few of these set pieces every year now. How did you think he did, Emma?
I thought he did very well, actually. I think this is one of his better performances. It was quite controlled, but also it didn't fall into the traps that Osborne was hoping to set. And I think the party had been pretty much laying out for about 2 weeks in advance of the statement that, you know, we would look at this from a different perspective rather than simply saying, you know, we will stop doing everything that you're doing, saying, well, we accept that we, because of the mess that you've made, we're stuck in this particular position, and here's where we will go from there. And it's quite interesting that instead of saying, the left of the Labour Party is saying Labour has capitulated to the Tories, and the Tories could have made a lot more hay out of that. They could be saying, you have accepted our narrative. And I don't think we have accepted the narrative, but they could say that. And they could make a good fist of that. But that's not the election they want to fight. They want to fight an election on the, you know, Labour just want to spend loads of money, and they don't really mean it when they say that they've accepted tight spending limits. So, you know, Ed Bulls did not fall into the trap of saying we will spend lots more money. And that wasn't the response that George Osborne was hoping for. And, the commentary, therefore, hasn't been Labour versus Tory. It's been, has Osborne succeeded or failed? I mean, the front page of the Sun, the day after the CSR, as far as the Conservatives were concerned, was not supposed to be a picture of Osborne eating a burger.
That bloody burger story, that's driven me nuts, that.
In what sense?
Oh, just in, like, why did the media always have to have some trivial hook to hang everything off? What's wrong with George Osborne having a burger that cost £10? It's almost like some of the coverage has been as if it's self-evident that that's terrible and, you know, what an awful person. It's like, come on, he was just having
a burger. I know, but normally I'm the person who defends, you know, Tory politicians being allowed to enjoy their little luxuries in life. But I agree that I do think it was bad PR, fundamentally, because it was no one in the weirdest, you know, huts of the birther community camping sites really believes that Osborne was deliberately advertising his mate's business in order to do some kind of insider dealing promotional deal.
Well, I mean, you know, that was part of the narrative. I thought it was just that, oh God, he had a posh burger rather than a burger.
That's right.
I don't even think that is particularly damaging. I mean, I really don't think people mind the Chancellor of the Exchequer having a decent meal as opposed to a McDonald's.
The idea that there's this separation between the 1% who have £10 burgers and everybody else who goes to Mackie D's. Yeah, you go to any decent local pub and you pay £10 for a nice burger these days.
It doesn't have to be Byron Burgers. It could be, you know, Gourmet Burger Kitchen, who no doubt will be furious that it wasn't them. But what I think the damage that it did do, though, was that I didn't even know that Byron was run by an Etonian of the same generation. You know, why on earth would I? But by writing about that, by bringing it to our attention, it did kind of remind us all that, yeah, Etonians of that generation and posh boys of that generation seem to do very well when they start up their own companies, and success, the magic touch, comes easy to this people and to these people, and that just reinforces the message that we're not all in it together. And I shouldn't be saying this. I am, you know, often the defender of, you know, the privileged going into public service, but that to me was what struck.
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, he had a burger, he was working late, one of his aides took a photo, and then someone took the decision to tweet it. I personally don't see read anything more into it than that. The acres of
coverage.
Tweeting
it was bad PR. It was a silly thing to do. And he seems to be running this pictures on his Twitter account on regular occasions, and very few of them have been done well.
Oh, I actually love his Twitter account. And I think, I remember when he joined, and he doesn't... No one at that office gets wound up by the huge amount of bile they get on Twitter, which...
Oh, no, it's not about the bile you get on Twitter. It's about the message you're giving that the papers reprint.
Sure. But I think they've done it well. I think the tweet of the red box, the whole sort of...
With the cat in it.
Yeah. I think that there's someone there who knows how Twitter works. It's not as great as Hillary Clinton's account, of course, but whose can be?
I would disagree. I mean, I think it's fine to be funny and have a little personality on Twitter. And I think some people do that really, really well. I think that only doing it before a big set piece says, I don't take these set pieces as seriously as I should.
Well, I mean, I we should probably move on from this, but I just don't think George Osborne could win, really, you know. And if you just hypothesise that all that happened was he had a burger and an aide took a photo and they just tweeted it, and there wasn't some Machiavellian plan behind it, they just did it.
Think there was a Machiavellian plan.
No, I don't think there was. Anyway, I wanted to broaden this out slightly that also what's been released this week, or been reported on this week, is that the Office for National Statistics have revised the figures for the last few years as regards how the economy has performed, the GDP figures. And a couple of significant things have happened. The first one is that the recession that happened in 2008 was actually worse than originally thought. So I think it was revised down from minus 6.3 to minus 7.2, which is quite a significant revision. Basically, it means it's going to be even harder for us to get back to where we were because it was worse. And then the other thing, which I think economically is completely insignificant, but politically is significant, is that there was no double dip recession. So actually the second quarter in, I think, 2010, 2010 or 2011, when we supposedly had negative growth, actually the growth was flat. So what that means actually is that all that reporting about double dip, and then all the further talk that was happening, you know, about 6 months or a year ago about a potential triple dip, hasn't come to pass. Kate, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think this really matters, or do you think it's just a storm in a teacup and no one will really care about it?
I actually think it's the type of thing that in 20 years, Tory politicians will be furiously banging on about in their memoirs. no one else will have noticed. You know, if only the public recognised that it wasn't quite a double dip recession, you know, I'd still be in Dorneywood or whatever it is. That's about the level of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like I said, I don't think it really matters economically because, you know, growth's been flat really for the last few years. I think that's the real story. But I can't help but wonder what would have happened if the figures had been more accurate, or if figures were reported in a different way, so that they don't go so heavily on the very, very first draft of the GDP figures that come out, and then everyone just runs with that as the narrative. Because I can't help but feel that that has damaged the country, because
I hugely agree.
It's got to be about the sentiment, hasn't it?
You know, come on, we've gone from 0.1% minus to 0%.
Exactly, but that's exactly my point, Emma. But Emma, that's
the people who read the numbers, make decisions, know what they're talking about.
No.
We're not talking about people who make decisions. We're talking, you know, at the top of the country. We're not talking about, you know, central bankers. We're talking about the confident people who want to take out a loan to start that small business or buy that new franchise, dip recession.
We've only got no growth. Let's spend.
Emma, I think you're missing the point. When people hear the word recession, or they hear the word double dip, or the term double dip recession, it knocks people's confidence. And at the margins, people who might have been wanting to make an investment or take another person on, they think, do you know what, we're still in a recession. Let's leave it 6 months a year. Let's see how we go. Whereas if that hadn't have happened, if it hadn't have been reported there was a recession, because technically there wasn't, I'm not saying this economically, it makes very much difference at all, but in terms of how people feel and the confidence in the country, I think that really could have had an effect. And actually, the reason I wanted to raise this was not so I could rub Labour's nose in it and say, the recession was worse under you, and there wasn't a double dip recession.
Well, actually, I think it's the opposite. I think more interestingly is we had a deeper recession under Labour that we got back out of. And then you may not have double dipped, but you dipped. So that growth that Labour actually managed to put back into the economy after what was an even worse recession after the international financial crash was actually even better than we originally thought. And then it was immediately halted as soon as this government came in.
OK, so do you think then, Emma, that the way that these things are reported is actually fine? Because I'm worried that there is actually a structural problem with the way we report these things.
I don't know. I think the idea that people making decisions about their business is based on a headline saying double dip recession doesn't strike me as the way I would run a business, doesn't strike me as the way any people I know who run businesses would do it. They base it on their own estimates of where their business is going and, you know, their own sense of what's happening within their own individual markets.
You don't think that headline after headline, week after week, month after month, term double dip recession, we're still in recession, the word recession repeated over and over and over again has any effect on confidence?
I think it affects the people who worry about the economy. I don't think it affects people who worry about their businesses.
What about their personal decisions? What about whether or not to take out that mortgage to buy the first home, to, you know, or even to just, you know, spend that
the decision
little bit
on whether to get a mortgage to buy your first home is based on whether you've got £30,000. If you've got £30,000, you're going to put it into property because no one thinks they're getting a pension anymore. But very few people have got the kind of capital they need to buy their first home. And that's nothing to do with whether we're in a recession or not.
I'm sceptical about this, Emma. I'm sure that there are all kinds of reasons why people take decisions, but surely an important factor, whether it's in the foreground or the background in people's minds, is how is the economy doing? And the word recession just, it scares people. And the fact is, since 2009, there has been no further recession. I know it's a technical point.
No, that's
point.
Not true. There was a recession. There wasn't a double dip recession, Mark.
No, there was a recession in 2008, and I think it went into the start of 2009. But since then, there has been no further recession. That is the truth. That is now what has been identified through the proper analysis. And it's taken years to recognise that. Now, if somehow we had a magic wand and we could get these figures all immediately, then I think there would have been a difference in the sentiment in the country. And it may have made a difference that, you know, because in the end, if you're so close to zero growth, then actually, you know, people taking different decisions because sentiment is a bit better could actually make quite a big difference accumulated over the course of several months or a few years.
OK, but Mark, let's talk about that magic wand. What are you actually suggesting? I mean, well, how much do you know about the ONS? What could we have done differently?
Do
you want to do hide the figures?
No, I did a blog post about this a little while ago where I highlighted actually just how strange it is the way we go about reporting whether we're in a recession, because you can have a situation over the course of a year where economic growth actually falls by 1%. And technically, you're not in a recession, because if it was like, you know, the quarters are kind of staggered and separated in when they dip and when they go back up again. But you could have a situation where the economy grows by 1%, and yet you're still considered to have had a recession during that year for the same reason, just in reverse. So we're in a bit of a strange situation. And my understanding is that the way that we go about defining recession is based on an article that someone wrote for the New York Times in about 1975, some economist. And for some reason, everyone ran with that way of defining it, where it's two consecutive quarters of negative growth. I'm saying that we should have a more sophisticated way of reporting this, and it shouldn't just rely on those figures. Now, I'm not an economist and I'm not an expert on this, but it feels too blunt at the moment. It feels like we need to have a better way of doing this.
Well, I shall have to dig out my my old economics notes. And before I can come up with my own very profound answer to that.
I don't think we're going to change reporting, and I don't think we should change reporting. That's public information. It's, you know, it's.
But it was wrong.
Information. It's
well,
wrong.
It does speak to the panic, and it. I mean, the media is not a monolith. The media is made up of people who live and work in this country. So yes, they like drama. They like melodrama, even. But while I've been very much on your side of this debate so far, Mark, I think the fact that people were desperate to scream double dip recession speaks to what those people writing the headlines felt too.
Oh yeah, bad news sells far better than good news.
No, but also people have felt they're living in bad news.
Yeah,
and so they've,
that's fair.
Because they themselves have been having difficulty getting mortgages, and well, I suppose the print media has been having such a decline over recent years that maybe maybe the whole of Fleet Street just has a jaundiced view of the economy overall. Maybe they're projecting their own words onto everybody else. But you know, news reporting is an artifact in itself that tells you about the mood of a certain sector of the
country. Okay, well, we're obviously not going to get agreement on that between myself and Emma, so maybe we'll move on from that. And we also wanted to talk about the royal family have been given some more money as well.
I can't find the figures, but I understand they've been, you know, they did quite well at the spending review.
Well, go bless them. That's what I say. I mean,
they don't have their shoulders, so they very much need more money. I think only having five palaces or whatever it is it must be very, very hard. And, you know, obviously the baby needs £1 million nursery. Maybe we could charge bedroom tax on it.
I think, to be fair to the baby, though, there was asbestos filling out the place. There was a lot of that money went on completely regutting and rematerializing the place. On the other hand, I'd say that...
Are the government going to pay if I get asbestos in my house and have to change it if I have a baby, will the government pay for that?
I think you should ask them.
I think they'd say no.
Emma.
Yes, but I was amused. There was a piece I was reading just today, actually, Matthew D'Ancona's piece in The Telegraph about Mandela, I think, started by saying, I'm just trying to find the link actually now, that Mandela had taught all political systems, even the Tories, that, yes, no political system could claim legitimacy until it recognised equality of worth. And then I thought, you know what? The Republic Conference was yesterday, and their latest campaign is called Born Equal, precisely because we're about to have a baby born who it will demonstrate to all 60 million of us that no, people aren't actually born equal in this country. You know, Mandela may have demonstrated to South Africa that that we have to recognise equality of birth and equality of worth in the individual. But defensive as I've been of the poor royals having their asbestos cleared out, there is a certain irony in this birth coming up in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I can't argue with any of that. I think it is inarguable that we are not all born equal under the kind of monarchy in which we have. I'm not in favour of the monarchy. I am very much a Republican. I don't necessarily think that that's going to be a campaign that I'll win in my lifetime.
Just wait till Charles gets on the throne, Emma. Then our day might come.
Well, maybe. Fingers crossed.
But you know, Charles is the prime mover in this latest push this last week to exempt the royal family from a lot of freedom of information requests.
Well, of course he is, because he's absolutely dreadful about political interference. And that's the big worry about Charles, is not that he'll be less popular than the Queen, but that he will take his role as head of state and do something very, very different with it and very concerning.
But also, I love all this commentary about how, you know, maybe we should skip a generation, we should go straight to wills because...
It works!
Sorry?
Exactly!
That was exactly going to be my point, that, you know, it seems...
We don't get to choose!
Exactly, the whole point of an hereditary monarchy is you get what you're given. You get whoever is next in line, and, you know, if they're not any good, hard luck, because it's an hereditary monarchy. As soon as you start saying, well, but he's not as popular as his son, so, well, you know, you're massively eroding and undermining the entire basis of the monarchy. Now I'm fine with that, so if they want to skip to wills, great, because they kick one of the props from under the edifice, but, you know, it ain't going to happen, because, you know, that's not how it works.
Well, you'd be surprised by the British royal family's ability to adapt to change and just about cling on. I mean, and in defence of British constitutional monarchy, I feel I should point out that, you know, 1688 and the Glorious Revolution did establish the principle of the sovereign ruling through parliamentary consent, you know, parliamentary sovereignty. William of Orange was invited by Parliament. And that principle remains very latent, because, of course, nothing is written.
Mm.
But, you know, it's still there.
Don't get me started on nothing being written.
Yes, and also, I mean, it may still be there, but it's certainly not been the case that they have that. I mean, Charles, you know, is very well known for trying to interfere in political decisions before he's the head of state. So, you know, once he's got that role, I can't see him changing his pattern of behaviour.
Oh, but haven't you read Dominic Grieve? It's all necessary training for him as an heir to the throne, because the moment he becomes monarch, he's going to sort of magically stop having any political opinions. it's the divinity. It's, you know, it's the divine spirit moving in the monarchy. He's being really engaged politically so as to understand the process. And then suddenly at that sort of clock stroke at which the breath passes to him, he's going to forget every opinion he's ever voiced. That's how it works.
I will look forward to that day.
Me too. Okay, the other thing, just before we move on to another subject on the spending review, is there were some ministerial no-shows, which I think you wanted to talk about, Emma, is that right?
Yeah, it was quite interesting. Chris Grayling didn't turn up to the debate in Parliament on legal aid.
Right.
And on the same day, I think it was, the Conservative Infrastructure Minister in the Lords didn't turn up to the debate on the infrastructure statement that Danny Alexander had presented to the Commons earlier. His Lib Dem counterpart went instead. And it just seems that there was an awful lot of fuss made, and quite rightly in many ways, about the way that Labour negated Parliament. Lots and lots of Conservative commentary on how Tony Blair misused Parliament, negated it, went over it, and that there would be a very, very different spirit within the Conservative-led government. And that seems to have gone by the wayside, and now we are seeing the same kinds of disrespect to the parliamentary process that Labour was accused of and that we were told would not happen under a new government.
Mm. you don't think that this is just, you know, one of those things that for one reason or another Chris Grayling couldn't make it, and it's a coincidence that the infrastructure minister couldn't make it either. So they had people standing in for them, presumably.
They did, but you know, they have their singular responsibility is to answer to Parliament on the big decisions they're making. The legal aid cuts are not a small thing; they're really quite big and important. And people from all sides of the debate, there, you know, David Davis was doing a sterling job leading for the Tories against these cuts and against these changes. So it wasn't simply the case that this was Labour trying to have a go at the Tories as a whole. This is a debate that needed to be had, and needed to be had by our elected representatives.
Yes, because if David Davis is involved, then, you know, clearly there's a noble and principled fight going on within the Tory party.
Well, I'm saying that it wasn't simply a party partisan issue. There were people fighting from both sides. So that was the only point I was making. It's not Labour trying to make trouble. It was people from all sides of the House, there were Lib Dems too, I believe, who were saying, look, this isn't on, we need to talk about this. And the person with whom they needed to talk about it with didn't come.
OK. Has the government got form for this, though? Have they done this on other occasions too?
They've done this on a number of occasions. They also refused various motions to discuss other things. For example, the Agricultural Wages Board is the most recent one that springs to mind, where they simply refused Parliament to debate on it.
Yeah. Well, that's not good. And you're right, it doesn't really fit in with the kind of rhetoric that was coming out before the election. You know, wasn't their manifesto your invitation to join the government of Great Britain?
It was indeed,
for example.
Which I think I believe I quoted in my piece on this on Labour List.
Yeah, I think you did, actually. I think I might have read that. It always seemed like a rather foolhardy title for a manifesto because it... But, I mean, I think it was a laudable aim, wasn't it, that ministers are going to be more accountable to Parliament? Because I do think under the Labour government that there was a tendency more towards this whole kind of sofa government thing and things being leaked to the media and not really feeling like Parliament was where things were properly happening. Mm. I mean, I would like to think it's a bit better now than it was, but maybe I would say that anyway, wouldn't I? I think if anything...
Well, the coalition has shifted the decision-making process in structural ways.
Exactly.
It's helped you.
That's right. Things have changed. I think, you know, there's a lot of negotiation that goes on behind closed doors, as it does in every government. But it's, I think it's even more acute with this government, isn't it? Do you think there's a problem here, Kate?
Well, no. And when I say the coalition has changed things and it's had to, I don't actually mean that more is going on behind closed doors. I mean, things get thrashed out by the Quad, by Danny Alexander and, you know, and Clegg versus, you know, the Osborne and Cameron. But then it has to be presented to Parliament. The votes are being counted every single time because the government's majorities are so tight in a way that they weren't under Labour. So, you know, I'd be disappointed if Chris Grayling didn't start showing up to answer some of these tough questions, because I think he has been absent from the debate and I haven't seen him making his case. A lot of journalists have been making it for him. You know, Harry Mount's been writing in the Tory press. But I would disagree. I think that coalitions are very healthy in that they force a formal negotiating process. You know, there are people on each side. There are Lib Dems, there are Conservatives. People are honest about the fact that that negotiation is part of the process. Whereas, in fact, when your coalition is actually just your own party, when you're constantly negotiating within an internecine warfare, then you tell the press that there aren't any divisions at all.
I don't remember any time, certainly in the last 5 years of Labour government, where we were telling the press there were no divisions.
Yes, you were. Yes, you were. The briefing was always...
Like no divisions, and it certainly didn't feel like the press was covering no divisions.
But it was denied constantly, and constantly Labour ministers would claim there was no spat, and, you know, Blair would be giving an ice cream to Brown on the campaign trail and all of that stuff.
Do you remember the Minghella advertisements, the election broadcast?
Yes, I remember that.
I think Gordon Brown at one point said, you know, we've even had our, like all old friends, we've had our differences, but, you know, the partnership endures. It was hilarious. But actually what I think is more seriously a problem is that the Labour Party hasn't been honest after government about the extent of the divisions that were going on. I mean, we understand why people cover up divisions when they're in government. But you remember when Ed Balls went on Newsnight, very, very, during the election contest, I think, the Labour leadership election contest. And Paxman put a question to him that was something on the lines of, so everyone says that you were, you know, you were Gordon Brown's bully boy. And he sort of said, oh, no, there weren't really any fights going on at all. You know, I don't know what people are talking about. Instead of being, you know, saying, well, actually, yes, politics is a tough game and we had ideological differences, and I was proud to stand up for one particular side of the Labour movement.
But isn't it worse than that, though, Kate? Because they weren't even really ideological differences, were they? They were more personality differences.
They were personality clashes and also ideological differences. And actually, most of the books that have come out since... I mean, Gordon Brown hasn't written his story. A lot of the books that have come out have been from the sort of New Labour, Peter Mandelson, Tony Blair...
Alistair Campbell
side of things, but they have, exposed fairly broad divisions. But I think, coming back to, I am not here to defend the last Labour government solely. I think we did some great things. I think we did some bad things. The idiocy of the eternal war, I have huge problems with, and I've written about it. I've been very open about the fact that it was unnecessarily stupid and divisive and made it harder to govern. But I think that that's not where we are now. And actually, what we're talking about now is some people who made some very, very highlighted promises about a different way of governing, a new politics. You don't hear that so much anymore. Things like,
from UKIP, unfortunately, but go on.
Things like, raising the profile and the power of Parliament. Things like funding 200 primaries, which is in the coalition agreement and has come absolutely nowhere. I mean, are there 200 left? 200 seats that haven't had their candidates selected for yet? That seems to have not been mentioned in the slightest in the last 3 years. We seem to have very much left behind any of these reforming ideas that were so central to the offer that was being given the country.
Yeah, well, you won't hear any argument from me about those points. I agree, and I think that the government has let itself and let us down by having rowed back on some of those things. We're going to run out of time soon, but there was one other thing we wanted to talk about, and I know Kate, you were particularly interested in talking about this about violent pornography. Do you want to just start us off by explaining?
Tell us about your interest in violent pornography.
Yes.
Oh, with pleasure, at length. I just waved goodbye to a parental visit just an hour ago. So yes, of course, I'm in the mood to talk about that. I think one of the problems here is that this is a response to a number of very, very unpleasant cases of paedophilia that have been in the news recently, the Tia Sharp one, but also the April Jones murder. Convictions in both of those were recent. And people have sort of started confusing child pornography with all other violent pornography, because child pornography, of course, is illegal. But one of the things that came out, I think it was in the Tia Sharp case, was that the murderer had also watched adult violent pornography before killing. So there was this inevitable push to ban all violent porn because it inevitably leads to real life violence, which personally I don't think it does. But it's bringing up a lot of issues about at the moment. I don't really want to bang on about it for hours, actually. I just thought that Emma might have some interesting things to say on the subject.
I'm afraid we're in danger of agreeing quite considerably on this. The debate about porn within the feminist movement is not as clear-cut as it's often portrayed to be. I'm not anti-porn at all. What two consenting adults, or two or three or four or five consenting adults, choose to do is up to them. And if they choose to do it on video and sell that, that's up to them. My real, real worry about banning anything that is consensual is that you then lump that in with the kind of material that is non-consensual, that is. And what you do is make it harder for those people who would have previously sold perfectly legal material to separate the legal material from the illegal material. You drive it underground and you make it harder to crack where the illegal stuff is being accessed.
I completely agree. And it also, it creates a world in which society or even the state sanctions one version of sexuality only. I'm just going to tell one story before we finish, partly because it's quite funny, but when I was at Yale University in the States, Yale hosts something called Sex Week, which supposedly is educational. But when I tell you that one session involved just lots of viewings of porn films in a big auditorium, you can make up your own minds about how educational it was. I wasn't there for this. Funnily enough, I had better things to do with my time. But there was quite a scandal caused on campus because someone started showing fairly bog-standard American pornography, and in particular, lots and lots of young women in cheerleader outfits. You know, smiling, stripping off the cheerleader outfits, stuff has started happening between the cheerleaders. This was all considered fine. A bit later, some hardcore BDSM, you know, bondage, submission stuff comes on. And one of the organizers leaps up, rushes over to the projector, screaming, "This is so offensive. I'm so sorry, everybody. This is so degrading to women." Switches it off and issues a public apology via and copies it to the student newspaper about apologizing for Yale Sex Week showing such degrading images of women. Now, I happen to find cheerleader porn really offensive to women, in the sense that, you know, I'm not out to ban it. I'm not out to ban anybody's porn. But my point is that one very bland, commercialized vision of how sexy women ought to be, i.e. wearing short skirts and pleasing men by being, you know, cheering for their sports teams as a sort of sexy sideline, that's one person's vision of what sexuality should be. And in this case, that was acceptable. Whereas, you know, whips and chains weren't.
Yeah, that sort of thing really irritates me, actually, because, you know, personally, I'm not into whips and chains. That's not my thing at all. But I know some people are. And if it's consensual and, you know, they're doing it, you know, themselves, and they're not causing harm to anyone else, then as far as I'm concerned, that's up to them. And so the idea that, you know, one particular type of porn, like you say, where you've got presumably women who are over the age of consent dressing up as cheerleaders.
But the theme is that they should be just about borderline if they're cheerleaders. It's a school thing, and that was considered acceptable.
Yeah, exactly. So there's connotations there, aren't there? And yet you're right. Somehow that's seen as mainstream and okay. In a context like that, and yet as soon as you move into the BDSM area, then suddenly that's seen as beyond the pale, even though, like, exactly like you say, there are some people for whom that's going to be an integral part of their sexual identity, and they're somehow made to feel like that is wrong.
I think also part of the problem with the way that we talk about porn is that we have this image of women don't use porn. I'm sorry, but who is it who's buying 50 Shades of Grey? And they're buying it because, not because it's very well written, it's terribly badly written, but it has a job to do, and it does it. It's utilitarian, and until we accept that women wank too, we will continue to look at porn as something men do to women and men use against women. And actually, there's plenty of women who use porn and plenty of women who, you know, find it a utilitarian thing. It's a thing that does a job for you, and that's all we need to understand. And we need to stop thinking of women as victims of porn, and rather think of them as users too. And then maybe we'll change porn as much as we'll change attitudes to sexuality and to pornography.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. I actually interviewed Anna Spann, who is a female porn director. She's actually quite famous in the porn world. And she was a Lib Dem PPC down in Essex, I think it was. Before the 2010 election, she actually got quite a lot of coverage for that.
Yeah.
And she has some very interesting views on this. We maybe get her on at some point, actually, maybe if we're going to cover this issue again. But we've run out of time, so it just remains for me to thank our guest, Kate, for coming tonight. Thank you very much.
Pleasure talking to you.
And also thanks, Emma, for being my co-host, as usual.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank Audio Boo, who very kindly hosts the podcast for us on the internet. And I'd also like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. Because that was, you were really on a roll there. Women wank too, that really should be a slogan.
Well, maybe it could be the headline.
I'm not going to put that on iTunes.